Okay, so I have a friend. And for the purposes of this confession, I'm going to change his name to Rafiq. His name is not Rafiq. Now, when I first met Paul Rafiq at university, I marveled because he was maybe the single most goofiest looking individual I'd ever seen up close. And it wasn't just his big ears and bug eyes and weirdly balanced head bone. It was his sense of style. This brother, he casually paired together a pith helmet with some high rider gym shorts, maybe throwing a Michael Jackson Thriller jacket on his way out of the door. And we're going to organic chemistry class, right? Not Comic-Con. And I don't know when I started forgetting what he looked like, but I did forget because his appearance wasn't the most important thing about him. And for real, this wacky flamboyance wasn't even the eighth or ninth most important thing about him, because he had this big old heart. Maybe I'm moping because some girlie's not feeling me the way I'm feeling her, and I get a note telling me to keep my head up from Rafiq. And it wasn't just me. He would show love to everybody like a child might, only he was a grown man. Steady listening to people's problems, big open smiles, way too loud laughs, ridiculous. One day he signed us up to hold babies at the hospital because he thought that would be a good idea. Fool, what you signing me up for? Well, I showed up. Yeah, it was a pretty good idea. And when we went out, the ladies, they dug him. This goofy looking dude. And the more he learned about himself, he decided he liked guys, and they liked him too. Who's your friend? He's so handsome. Rafiq is a lot of things. Handsome is not one of them. We ended up living together, graduated university, and I moved away. We didn't get to hang out enough, you know? But he was still in my heart. And one day I go to his hometown where he lives, and I'm at a coffee shop with a friend, and I am excited. I tell her, I cannot wait for you to meet Rafiq. And in the meantime, what kind of people watching? Look. That one's got that big hair. And that dude's doing a Monty Python walk. And then she says, wow, check out this guy. And of course, there he is, Rafiq. And I am so happy. But for a moment, I try to see him through her eyes, walking through downtown in a wizard cape, cowboy boots and a Superman shirt. And I'm like, listen, you are not gonna believe this. I know this, but that dude right there is the coolest dude in the world. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Eye of the Beholder. Amazing stories from real people who are not as they may appear. My name is Glenn Washington. Please, get your top hat and snowmobile boots out, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Okay, Snappers, before we even get started, I want you to know that we have changed the names of some of the participants in this next story to protect the innocent, and they are all innocent. Now, in Snap Judgment, you know that we have taken you to the highest mountaintops and to the depths of the deepest sea, but today, we're about to take you to one of the most scariest places ever, summer camp.
It's 3 days before the big dance at Camp Discovery in northern Minnesota. Camp's in full swing. They're singing around the campfire. Kids are at waterfront.
You still can't do it.
They're playing those trust games where you get blindfolded and have to walk around cones.
Right. Four. Left. Forward.
But there's also so much excitement about the dance. Everybody's scrambling to get a date, and there are more girls than boys.
There's so much drama. Oh my goodness.
Caitlin's 13. She's into gymnastics. She has long, dark brown hair. She's popular. And she says if you want to stay up on the drama, who's asked who got dumped, there's one place to be.
If you go play basketball, usually you're like, the basketball crowd is kind of the gossip area. That's where most of the things happen.
And the negotiations of who's going to ask who are kind of complicated.
So it's kind of like, oh, I want him. Wait, I also want him kind of thing. And then you have one friend who wants to go with him, but it's like, oh, wait, I wanted him too. So should you say yes because you're my friend? Or
most of the boys seem like they could care less about the drama and the dance. Except Nathan. He's a boy on a mission to get a date. Nathan's 11, funny, and a little sheltered. This is his third summer at camp.
That's one of the reasons I like to come here, because you don't have a parent to keep going, hey, don't do that, no, hey, don't do that. But in other cases, it's learning what happens when you don't listen to your parents.
Last year, Nathan had an amazing time at the dance. He was too embarrassed to ask anybody, but he wore a suit, which was a big hit. This year, he really wants to go with someone. He's already asked one girl.
And I might have gotten rejected. I don't know yet. She said, I don't know, and I'm so nervous because I want to take her.
What are you going to ask again?
Yes.
What's going to go through your head when you walk up to her?
Fear. mostly fear. You know, what girls do when they like a guy, they hit him, they do stuff like that, I know from experience. And guys, I don't know what they do. Showing off, that's what boys do.
So Nathan asks the girl again. She says no.
I cried in the cabin. I cried in my bed. I cried in the bathroom.
Why were you crying?
Well, because I had never been rejected before.
Never?
Never. Not like that.
Most of the kids here are really used to getting rejected because they all have skin diseases. Some kids have splotches or moles or scales. Some are bald or allergic to the sun. Some have life-threatening diseases. There are kids who get enormous blisters from just walking, eating, even changes in temperature. They're covered in bandages. They're in wheelchairs. Camp's swarming with dermatologists and nurses. There's a big table in the mess hall where kids line up to get their medicine. Compared to a lot of the campers, Caitlin's skin disease is pretty mild. She has eczema. She's an army brat, and every time she starts a new school, she has to explain what's wrong with her skin.
I remember one time I was going up to get a math sheet, and there was this person who I thought was beginning to be my friend, kind of. And I was going up to get a sheet, and she touched my elbow, which was really dry and rough at that time. And she like yelled really loud, "Ew, that's disgusting. Your elbow's so rough and dry." And then everybody came over and touched my elbow, and I felt like, you know how you go to a museum or something and you're all staring at like a lizard inside a box or something? I felt like so much like that.
Everybody at camp has this feeling like all the time in their normal lives. I have a skin disease. I've had this feeling. I came to this camp as a kid and as a counselor.
It's not like you're at a regular camp, but it's the only time you'll ever be normal.
There's a sense here that you can just do whatever you want, be whoever you want, and your personality can completely change from school to here. I think this is a complete bully-free zone.
At Camp Discovery, Caitlin's not a lizard. She's beautiful. She has her pick of suitors, but she only has eyes for Christian, a boy in a wheelchair who has epidermolysis bullosa. It's the most severe disease at camp. In some cases, it's fatal.
Christian's skin is covered in blisters. His hands and feet are knotted and fused with scar tissue. His arms and legs are covered in bandages. And last year, he and Caitlin, they hung out.
We talked a lot during the dance, and after horseback riding, we went and saw the puppies and stuff. That was pretty cute, and took pictures with him and the puppies.
Okay, so you guys definitely, you know each
other. Friends, yes. Yeah. It's kind of cute, I guess. Last year, we danced a lot, and he asked to take a picture with me at the end of the dance.
But it turns out Rachel, Caitlin's cabin mate, also likes Christian. Rachel's quiet, funny, but quiet. She doesn't want to be interviewed. She has a disease called vitiligo, so her skin's really, really blotchy. Rachel's already going to the dance with Christian, but she invites Caitlin to come as a sort of triple date. This is a power move in the world of middle school girl politics. They're both going to the dance with Christian, and nobody's feelings are getting hurt. Meanwhile, Nathan is still on the hunt for a date. He's also got EB, but not as badly as Christian. He wears bandages on his hands, elbows, and feet.
It's basically where there's layers of skin, and my skin, it doesn't have the glue between the layers, so it just peels easily.
And it, like, makes blisters?
Yeah, blisters. It's junctional EB. It's not the worst, but it's not the best.
Now, there is a girl who likes Nathan. She's cute, but her skin is worse than those other girls. Nathan doesn't ask her to the dance. He asks someone else. And girls whose skin diseases you can't really see keep turning him down.
One of the reasons why I aim for the pretty girls is I can't see myself. In my head, I have an envisioning of, like, a kid with no blemishes on the skin, and so I just went for them first.
I mean, when you think about the possibility of you not being asked because of your skin, how does it feel?
A bit of anger, but I would understand.
Why would you understand?
Because I didn't ask Savannah. I mean, it's not all because of her skin, it's just, well, some of it is, yeah.
You know, like thinking about how she feels, you know, not being asked maybe a little bit because of her skin.
Yeah.
What does it make you feel like?
I don't feel like a total monster, but it seems a bit mean, just a bit.
So at skin camp, looks matter, unless you have really bad EB, the blistering disease. These kids, bandaged and in wheelchairs, they become the darlings of camp, especially the boys, who usually end up getting asked to the dance. The last day of camp, before the dance, a lot of girls leave Waterfront early to get ready. Caitlin's the cabin makeup guru. She helps other girls with eyeliner and lipstick. The boys aren't so worried about how they look. Nathan's one of the first kids ready for the dance. He tells me he brushed his teeth and used Axe body wash. He brought his dress pants to camp, but he's packed them, so he's wearing yellow gym shorts. The mess hall's all decorated. The tables are pushed to the sides. The lights are low. Music's pumping. Caitlin and Rachel look cute in their dresses. Christian's wearing a button-down shirt, and they head into the dance together. Nathan waits outside for his date. It's been a rough week, getting rejected by girls he thought were in his league. At the last minute, his date ditches him, and he's left alone.
Feel a bit sad that I was rejected again. Basically, I don't know if I was rejected. But.
It's time to slow down.
Okay, I'm outside.
Are you gonna stay outside during the slow dance?
I wonder if my date will come and find me. If I still do have one. I wonder if I have a plan E.
Do you need a plan E?
Maybe. Just in case. Nah, I don't like slow dancing.
I don't either.
I don't either.
It's the worst.
I slow danced once. With one in the here and they're like.
Nathan's pretty bummed. So I let him call his mom from my phone. He explained what happened with all his dates.
Wait, tonight's the dance.
Yes, it is. But
so what will you do?
Well,
because last year, did you tell Sarah what you did last year?
Last year, what happened?
You took your nice suit and you didn't plan to ask a girl, and girls were telling you to ask someone, and you absolutely refused to. You just went and danced and had a great time.
I was embarrassed, yeah.
So you were too embarrassed last year to ask?
Yes.
But you wore that wonderful suit, which you then got all bloody.
Oh, so he did tell you about that?
Yes, that he came home wearing a bloody suit?
With shower shoes that he had worn to the dance the night before, and you know he has fragile skin, and someone had stepped on his foot that night at the dance.
Yeah.
And about a third of his foot was a new wound, and he was so excited and tired he couldn't tell anyone, so he traveled home that way.
Oh my God.
I know. He's not allowed to come home without making sure that, you know, somebody's looked at his hands and feet at least. A little bit. So Sarah said that she'd like me to encourage you to go in right now, and so that means right now.
Okay.
Can you do that for
yes.
both of us?
Yes, ma'am.
I love you, son.
Love you, Mama.
So Nathan, finally, heads into the dance. Inside, things start off okay. I ask Rachel how it's going. She says, go talk to Christian.
Can I talk to you? You have two dates. What's that like?
It's fun.
Yeah? What's the best part about having two dates to the dance?
Dancing.
It's pretty nice. You get to dance with both of them.
What?
Yeah. I said you get to dance with both of them.
Oh.
But the thing is, he's not dancing with Caitlin. She's disappeared and is dancing with her friends. Christian starts asking Rachel where Caitlin is. He gets more and more upset. And then he storms out of the mess hall and back to the boys' cabin, barricading his wheelchair against the door. Counselors finally convince them all to come back into the dance, and they start dancing in this weird, sad line. Rachel's holding a counselor's hand on one side, Christian on the other. Christian's holding Caitlin's hand, and her face is buried in her counselor's stomach. She's sobbing. The dance ends and they all leave sad.
Because it like broke my heart to think that he probably doesn't get this much attention at all, and then I ask him to dance and I don't dance with him. I just wanted to dance with some of my friends. It's like I'm being a bully. And I felt like I was a bully in a place where there's supposed to be a bully-free zone.
Yeah. You know, it's like it's cool to go to the dance with a kid who has the worst skin disease, but then you don't dance with him, you know?
Yeah, it's like, it makes it even worse that, like, the people who have it worse, I'm also, like, the meanest to, it feels like. Like, all of a sudden that I'm picking on the ones that, like, I went to the dance purposely to go to not dance with him.
I don't think anybody thinks that's true.
I do.
Well, I guess this is something where you just kind of learn, you know?
Yeah. Right now, I feel like I'm not learning anything, but right now it just feels like this is mean pain.
And the night still isn't over. I'm talking to Caitlin by the bunks when there's a knock on the door. It's Christian, flanked by counselors. He's come with flowers, and he asks for Caitlin. Yeah, I will. Sure. But Caitlin's so embarrassed and ashamed, she hesitates to even go to the door.
I feel so much better.
Oh,
let's do it.
Yeah, you are.
No, every time I look at him, I feel 10 times worse.
I know, but that's why we gotta fix it.
It won't be fixed. I'll always feel like this.
You don't have to always feel like this.
But I will. When I get something in my head that I did something wrong, I just feel like that forever.
He wants to make it better. Yes,
because he did nothing wrong.
He wants to talk to you. He doesn't know that he did nothing wrong. He wants to talk to you and work it out.
So Caitlin, reluctantly, goes to the door.
Go on, lady. You got it.
Come on. Okay. I'll be over there, too.
Sorry, okay?
Thank you. I'm sorry, too.
Caitlin's counselors whisper to her to see if she can give Christian a hug.
No. Can I give you a hug? Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, too.
Mommy.
Christian hands Caitlin a little bouquet of flowers. The thing is, Christian has spent the whole night chasing Caitlin. Rachel, the girl with the more visible skin disease, his other date, has been forgotten. Lacey's their counselor. She's a dermatology resident, and she watched the whole night unfold.
I think it probably is the most painful thing I've ever watched in person.
Why?
I think mostly because this camp is supposed to be a place where kids are safe from things like this, and they come here to fit in possibly for the first time in their whole lives. And even the ones who are doing the hurting, they understand what they're doing to the other kids, but they can't stop doing it.
I mean, yeah, that's like the catch-22 of this place, right? Like,
it has its own hierarchy, and in some ways it's different than the rest of the world, but in other ways it isn't, because even that backfires. I just wish that this wasn't a place that could even happen, I guess.
She says that kind of makes it worse. A rough night turns into a rough morning. At the airport, all the kids are hugging and crying. Getting on that plane means heading back to the real world. Even though last night's drama was intense, nobody wants to go home.
Yes, there is lots of love for everyone at Camp Discovery. It's sponsored by the American Academy of Dermatology, and it is free, it is fun. Learn more about it by going to aad.org and searching for Camp Discovery. We'll also have a link on snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Sarah Harris. Now, Sarah is a reporter at North Country Public Radio in Northern New York. Now, Sarah received the assist from our own Anna Sussman, with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Snap returns. A relationship is doomed before it even gets started. And we introduce you to the very best dentist in the world. For real, when Snap Judgment, the Eye of the Beholder episode continues, stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Eye of the Beholder special. Today, just because things look one way to one person doesn't mean that's the way they really are. Case in point, our next story comes to us by way of a fantastic new show called Israel Story. And in it, producer Shoshi Shmulevitz finds out what happens when, at long last, you cave in to your parents' demands.
It was about 7 years ago that Ghazi Albalui's father was first diagnosed with kidney cancer. And Ghazi still remembers the day, about 3 years into the treatment, when he took his dad home from the hospital.
And he just stopped me at a stoplight. And I remember exactly where it was, like Court and Warren in Brooklyn. And he turns to me as we're waiting for this light to change. And he turns, he goes, you know, I want to see your children before I die. That statement right there propelled me to do things that I'd never thought I would do.
You see, Ghazi's parents were originally Palestinian refugees, and they'd been pressuring him for a long time to get married to a traditional Muslim girl. But even though he was born in a refugee camp, Ghazi always felt more American than Palestinian. So this idea of settling down, it really terrified him, particularly because of the way he was expected to settle down.
You can't date without being married. That's like the Islamic way. You can't date someone without marrying them. So it's like the ultimate let's play Russian roulette with your life way of marriage. It's like, oh, you really? Well, let's get married and then let's date.
But Ghazi also knew that he loved his dad and that before he died, he wanted to give him those grandchildren.
So I did something very impulsive. I had a conversation with my mom, which I never thought I would have with her, but I was like, look, I want to compromise with you guys. I want a woman who is more on the modern side of things. We're Jordanian, Palestinian. I think Queen Rania of Jordan is amazingly beautiful. If I can find someone like Queen Rania of Jordan, I would be so happy. And so my mom's exact words, Queen Rania, yeah, her family's from Tulkarm, where our relatives live. I'll tell you what, in Tulkarm, it's like going to a lemon tree. You could pick all the Queen Ranias you want. You could just pluck them out. And she did this thing with her hands where she mimed plucking a Queen Rania off a tree. And I'm like visualizing like beautiful women hanging like Queen Rania on a tree that I would just pluck out when I got there. So I book a ticket.
And the next thing he knows, Ghazi is flying into Tel Aviv, hailing a taxi, and getting dropped off at a checkpoint in the West Bank.
And now I'm walking towards soldiers with a huge suitcase who are literally looking at me with their guns up. Not pointing at me, but they're like, kind of like, what is this guy doing? And I'm like, oh. This is when it dawns on me that this might be a really big mistake. You should not have left Brooklyn. So I go into Tulkarm and I go to what my father told me to go to, which is a section of the refugee camp that my family lives in. Harat al-Balawna, neighborhood of the Balawna. The Balawna is my family tribal name. And that is where I pull up and, you know, meet my family. And then eventually they start taking me around to meet women. You sit down, there's the men of the girl's family on one side of the living room. My family guys sit on one side. And then you're just kind of waiting there. You kind of small talk. People are like chain smoking these rooms. And like, I'm like dying here. And then eventually the girl, and it's almost every time verbatim. The girl comes out with a tray of drinks. She serves all the men. And the last drink is for you. She makes eye contact with you, then sits with her relatives. And then you just sit and you just stare at each other like something's supposed to happen. It's such a weird thing, but a lot of these girls would come out of these rooms and I'm thinking Queen Rania all the way. I'm thinking this is going to be a hot girl coming through this door.
And the first woman he met was attractive.
Turned out to be my 17-year-old second cousin. She was actually kind of cute.
But the cousin thing was a deal breaker for Ghazi, so he kept looking.
I sat with one girl, Islamic girl, who was a pharmacist. So you could go, oh, she's like a scientist. She asked me, do you pray? I said, no, I'm going to be very honest with you. I'm not going to lie. I don't pray. She goes, oh, you're going to go to hell. I guess that's Tulkarm's version of, can I please have the check?
A week goes by, a week and a half. Ghazi's going from house to house, drinking tea, meeting women. But he keeps striking out. On top of that, the conditions of the refugee camp where his family lives are really starting to get to him.
The refugee camp is just like such a depressing thing. Kids with no shoes on, people are poor, dirt everywhere. I would take 3 showers a day. Nice Jewish settlements with nice clean houses across the fence, which I watch every day. And I wish, why couldn't my family have been Jewish settlers? Why? So I'm already like checked out. I'm going back to New York. That's it, I'm done. I kind of did what I had to do here for my father. And then like someone goes, look, there's this girl. Let's just go see her. She's at an amusement park with her mom. We know her. We already talked. They're going to meet us there. So I go with my cousin and my niece. I'm not expecting anything. Get to the amusement park, meet the mom. She goes, oh, she's with her sister on the Ferris wheel. And it's a Ferris wheel supposed to do a 360. It's supposed to do circles. But this is Tulkarm. The Ferris wheel is not doing 360s. It is doing a 180. So it would go up and then come down like a crescent moon. It's like everything is breaking down in here. The bumper cars are not bumping. They had like a zoo. The snake died, they told me. It's like so sad, the conditions there. I mean, people need... And so... Anyway, so I'm trying to figure out what this girl looks like because the Ferris wheel is coming down, going up, coming down, going up. But this girl gets out and I like focus on her and the girl looked like Audrey Hepburn. She wasn't wearing a hijab, very Western looking, had really cool looking jeans. I say hello to her. She's a little shy. We walk back to her mom. I sit with her mom. We're talking.
Her family, it turned out, was a lot like Ghazi's. Muslim, but modern. And unlike his relatives, they actually lived outside the refugee camp in a nicer part of town. If there was a deal breaker, Ghazi couldn't find one.
The conversation turns to, do you ever let your daughter go to live in America? I live in New York. It's really nice there. Mom's like, yeah, totally. And, you know, it was kind of a done deal there. I was like, oh, if the mom is agreeing to this, it's cool. And, you know, I thought she was innocent. And a part of me thought, you know what? I can give her a great life. We can love each other. She can take care of me. I can take care of her. And I'm walking back with my cousin. I'm like, dude, done. I'm ready. Let's get the guys. Let's just do this. We got married on Christmas, December 25th. I remember that specifically. I thought it was really romantic that I got married on Christmas. We go to the Islamic Sharia court, and then I sign this wedding contract. And at that point, she is my wife, right? But really, in their eyes, she's only my fiance. Even though we're married on paper, she's not really your wife until that wedding night when we give her to your family and she becomes yours.
But now that Ghazi and, let's call her Farah, are technically married, they no longer need supervision, meaning they're allowed to be alone together while the two families prepare for the big wedding.
And what you get to feel as you go along is this person is totally uncomfortable with me, which I can totally understand that.
But one thing Ghazi's aunts and uncles couldn't understand, and which was kind of bothering them, was that Farah's family kept asking Ghazi to buy things for them, ice cream, aspirin, stuff like that.
And it's such not the Arab customary thing. Usually if you're a guest of an Arab household, Arabs are just like so offended that you would even suggest paying for anything because you're like the house guest.
Still, Ghazi doesn't want to rock the boat, so he goes along with it. And then one night, Farah finds him in his room.
She comes in and she goes, oh, I want to show you pictures of my brother, who her brother's a police officer in training. She comes from a cop family. And she opens up this folder and there's a bunch of photos in there. It's just photos of her brother doing kind of like an obstacle course. He's climbing the rope. He's like running. It's hot out. You can see guys with their shirts off. And then at a certain point, it's him posing with his shirt off. And then him posing with his shirt off with a gun, like a machine gun, cigarette in his mouth, like seductive pose. And then she turns to me, she goes, isn't he tasty? I'm like, huh? Isn't he tasty? And she goes, can't you see why all the girls want him? But the way she said it, I'm like, what the hell, Jess? It's like the fourth day, and I'm like, this family is nuts. And my younger cousin brought up the fact that she was not the virgin image of a girl who stays home. She's, you know, she's gone out with some guys behind her family's back, you know, stuff that I have no idea about until, you know, of course, until I signed the wedding contract.
But Ghazi, like, come on, like you want a modern, like westernized girl who's not wearing a hijab, but then she also has to be a virgin.
Yeah, but you know what? It's this whole fantasy that my parents built up for me that said, you know what? All these girls in Tulkarm are under lock and key. You're going to get yourself a girl that has not been polluted by society. And then, you know, and of course, they're also throwing in the fact that she's going to look like, you know, Queen Rania of Jordan. And so, like, all that builds up. And then, you know, you finally get someone that kind of resembles your fantasy. And then the fantasy starts to crack.
Meanwhile, Ghazi is making more and more purchases. Farah's mother, he says, turns out to be something of a big-time spender, and she's having him pay not just for incidentals, but for nights out, groceries, even utility bills. And Farah doesn't seem to be warming up to him at all. In fact, she just gets colder until she finally puts her foot down and says that there won't be any sex on the wedding night.
And so at a certain point, you know, you stop and you think and you go, okay, this family's using me for my money. And this person didn't see a life with me, but her mom probably pushed her into marrying me, which was not cool. And that this girl signed on the dotted line.
So Ghazi finally decides to put his own foot down.
We're going to go buy a wedding dress the next day. If she asks for an expensive wedding dress, I'm done with her. I'm going to tell her I can't marry you.
And sure enough, the dress that Farah and her mother pick out is super expensive.
I kind of was like, tell her we're going to another wedding gown store. I think that's a little high. Mother comes out, doesn't look happy. My wife comes out, doesn't look happy. Start walking, silence. And I turned to my wife. I'm like, oh, what's wrong? Oh, you know what's wrong. You shouldn't have upset my mother. She said it in such a way that I just stopped without, it's been building up. I was like, you know what? Can't do this. I divorce you.
Then Ghazi turns around and leaves Farah and her mother just standing there in the street.
So I had a nervous breakdown. A nervous breakdown being I cry, scream, and then walk through a refugee camp just cursing myself. I tell my uncle, I gotta get out of this. Somewhere, don't worry, stop, stop. You like, don't cry. I'm like, 34-year-old guy crying. I've been like robbed at gunpoint in Brooklyn and I never cried then. I peed on myself, but I didn't cry. And here I am like walking through this room, just crying. It's like, stop, don't cry. I know this great lawyer. I'm like, who is this lawyer? He goes, don't worry. He's the best in all of Tulkarm. His name is Arafat Arafat. Like, so, like, it was enough to make me stop crying and go, Arafat Arafat? He's like, yes, Arafat Arafat. He's the best lawyer in all of Tulkarm.
And at this point, Ghazi needs a lawyer. He knows he just left Farah and her family hanging in a big way, and in public, no less. So he walks back into town to meet with Arafat Arafat.
And he's like, tell me, what happened? I was like, Arafat Arafat, this is what happened. He goes, did you enter her? And he made a hole with his finger and he put the... I said, no, I tried to. I wish I had entered her. He goes, okay, that's good. That's good. And he sits back in his chair and he thinks, that's good. I said, listen, I got to get out of here. I've had it. I'm nervous breakdown. I've been crying. Look at my eyes. He goes, why were you crying? Because men don't cry. He's like, so she's like, this is too much for me. He goes, don't worry about it. You're not really married to her. I said, but dude, I have this one. He goes, yeah, technically you are, as far as Allah is concerned, that you are married to this girl, but you didn't have sex with her. So there's kind of like purity to who she is. He goes, sign this. It's a power of attorney. I will be you here in Tulkarm. He goes, don't worry. I'm going to make it all better. Go back to America. I will take care of this for you. And then I get this call from her uncle, the chief of police, who, as I know now, is a nut job. He has had people's legs broken for my wife, just whistling or like saying something to her in a like a come on way. Like, two guys ended up in wheelchairs for like 2 months.
But it was even worse than Ghazi knew at that moment, because marrying Farah wasn't the only mistake he'd made.
In my hysteria, I had told someone in town, she's not gonna have sex with me, she's having sex with her brother. Like, because I'm having a nervous breakdown. This, like, coupled with the fact that I just divorced her, got back to the brother. So the brother said he had dishonored our family by saying I had sex with my sister. I issue a fatwa against this guy. If he is to show his face at any point, I will kill him dead in the street. Now, her uncle saying, oh, I'm going to send the police car to come get you, and we should really talk about this. I'm like, I started freaking out. This guy's going to kill me. I said, listen, I'm really emotional. I can't talk right now. I need to drink some tea, relax. I'll come see you in the morning. He goes, you're going to come in the morning? I said, yeah. I was like, where am I going to go? I'm in Tulkarm. He goes, all right, I'll send a car for you in the morning. Hung up the phone, ran into my room in that refugee camp, packed that suitcase up. Everyone had gone to sleep. And I just lay there with the suitcase, holding the suitcase like it was my mother. And every time a light would come under the door, I'm like, they're coming for me. They're coming. They're going to come get me. And I wait. I know the buses start running at like 5. I pick up that suitcase. I don't even say anything to my relatives. I run through that door. And now I'm running through the refugee camp. It's like semi-dark. The sun is coming out. Chickens are like cackling. And I'm running with the suitcase on my head. And I'm like running through alleyways. People are in their underwear. I see people through windows. I see people having breakfast. I see the news. And I get to the bus. I remember getting on that bus. I'm like, oh, please don't let them stop this bus at the checkpoint. Got past the Palestinian checkpoint. Get to the Israeli checkpoint. Now we're on our road. End up in Ramallah.
At which point, Ghazi takes another taxi out of the West Bank and into Jerusalem. Then he boards a flight to take him back to New York. Later, the two families would reach a divorce agreement, but Ghazi says at first he felt remorse.
Because I misjudged the situation that I was walking into. I go to a place that I've never been to before, to a culture that I have no idea how it operates. I'm trying to play a game that belongs to another person with this idea my parents had written for me, and I shouldn't even be there.
all of which is on his mind when he's finally back in Brooklyn at his parents' door.
They're like, hey, look who's home. I was like, hey, so did you hear anything from our relatives about Arafat? They're like, don't worry about it. It was like such a nonchalant, you'll get better, it's okay, right? This is after I'd gone through everything. And then they turn back and they watch Al Jazeera. Here's a punchline. My dad was not dying.
Today, Ghazi is 38, still single, and his father is still alive, holding out for Ghazi to get married in the traditional way to a nice Muslim girl.
He just Jewish guilted me in his own Arab way to get married for him. And, you know, I kind of feel it still. You love your parents so much that you end up hating yourself, and that's where I am today. I love them so much that I hate myself. Look at what I did. I shouldn't have done that, but I did it because I love them.
Thank you so much, Ghazi, for sharing your story. We know that with a game like that, you're going to find a bride soon. The story is produced by Shoshi Smulovitz with sound design by Tarek Fuda. It was adapted for Snap by Joe Rosenberg and Renzo Gorio. And if you want to hear more Israel story goodness in both Hebrew and English, check out the links on our website, snapjudgment.org. When Snap Judgment returns, we discover how to make a good impression when it matters most of all. Keep it locked, because the Snap Judgment Eye of the Beholder episode will be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment. From PRX and NPR, the Eye of the Beholder episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're looking at the same situation from very different vantage points. Now, you already know that everyone hates going to the dentist. Everyone. And our next storyteller, Alana Massey, she hated it so much that she put it off for years and years and years.
It had been, I believe, 8 years since I had been to the dentist. And so I had cavities that I needed to be filled. And I had gone in on a Monday and was asked to come back on a Thursday. I came up to the receptionist, who is a different woman than had been there in my initial consultation. She said that my name wasn't in the calendar. Then she said, there's not a record of you in the calendar. I was really confused because I had been there days prior. Something's weird. I was waiting in the waiting room and my dentist came out, and she's this very lovely, unassuming person who had been kind but not overly friendly necessarily. And she looked like a kid that woke up from a nightmare. She was completely white, she was stunned, looked like, you know, she had seen something terrifying, jaw drop. I was really confused. She had started crying, and she said, can I give you a hug? I had no idea why. She said, Alana, you're alive. They told me you had passed away. She told me she called me the evening before, and whoever answered said that I had died. And she pulled out her phone and had switched a 9 in for a 6 in my number. That's how she ended up thinking I was dead. After we had had this long embrace that she had stayed up all night, that she had told her husband about me, that she couldn't sleep because she was thinking about how young I was and how promising I was. I was not expecting the candidness of what she said, which was, I was sad that you were gone. It was a very sort of like intimate expression of care and of mourning. And we were still in the middle of the waiting room. I think it would be a story in anyone's life. I think my dentist probably has no idea how profoundly it affected me. It was the late winter, and in the spring, I checked into Bellevue Hospital with suicidal ideation and, like, suicidal intentions. Before that, I had sort of made the attempts to call suicide hotlines. One of the things they say is, like, sort of have a survival kit. It's like pictures of your mom and dad and pictures of yourself as a baby and like notes that you have. Mine is just a digital album on my iPhone that's just called Stuff. I loaded it up with pictures of my family and screenshots of really kind messages from friends. And the dentist has a website with her photo on it, and I clicked on the image of my dentist's headshot, saved it into my phone, and put it in the folder that's called Stuff. I can still feel what that feels like when I think about her. If she loved me that much in a day, than how many people love me in the course of my life. And I'm putting the word love in her mouth. I eventually, you know, got a diagnosis of bipolar 2. As many as 25 to 50% of people with the diagnosis attempt suicide. A year and a half later, in the summer of 2014, I had a complete mental breakdown. And during those hours, I really needed something small to hold on to. And a phone is small, and a picture is small. While this was happening, you know, the photo of my dentist was still there in the folder that's called Stuff.
Big thanks to Alana Massey for sharing your story with The Snap. It was produced by Anna Sussman, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. End of the show is not the end of the show, no. Your storytelling adventure is just getting started. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment Podcast and get storytelling delivered each and every week. Snapjudgment.org. Get in the Snap Nation conversation on Facebook, on Twitter, hit me, friend me, like me, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. And Snap was produced by myself and the team that always wears rose-colored glasses. Please behold the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. The Beat That Time Forgot, Pat Macedi Miller, Anna, the Snake Eye Sussman, Evil Eye, Julia DeWitt, Joe, By the By Rosenberg, Nancy, Why Ask Why Lopez, Davey Do or Die Kim, Renzo Martin Meat Fly, Gorio, our Snap Crack Give Up the Dap crew, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, and Leon Morimoto, Matt Ducat Ducant, and Jasmine Aguilera, locks the door. We'll be right back. you. If someone you know has ever enjoyed a nice piece of fried chicken, please know the whole idea of chicken frying was invented by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Look it up on Wikipedia. Many thanks to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, invented a popular side dish some call the French fry. I saw him do it, PRX.org. And now, as you may have already ascertained, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could dig for 30 years in Egypt's Valley of the Kings, open up a pharaoh sarcophagus, only discover French fries in a PRX tote bag, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.